Welcome to The Art of Authenticity, a weekly podcast that explores what it really means to be authentic and build a life that's truly you, featuring in-depth interviews with successful business leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, and thinkers. By sharing their stories, daily practices, and habits, they will help you find a life that is successful and authentic. I'm your host, Laura Coe, author, entrepreneur, and coach. Welcome to the show. Welcome to this episode. I am excited that Farnoosh Torabi has honored us by coming on to talk about how she went from a young woman struggling in New York to a massively successful financial expert, best-selling author, TV personality, and sought-after speaker. Her podcast, So Money, was voted number one in finance, and she's been on everything from Yahoo, Today Show, Money Magazine, CBS, Dr. Oz. I mean, honestly, name something, and she's probably been on it. I've been on her show, So Money, and now I'm honored to have her on The Art of Authenticity. I know you will love this show because she shares how she went from $30,000 in debt, where she was actually bird-sitting for extra cash, to where she is today. You will hear her thoughts on all sorts of financial questions and specifically how the world is changing its view that men should be the breadwinner and what it means in modern relationship dynamics. Finally, she'll tell us how she does it all without losing track of what really matters to her, her family time. Enjoy the show, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe and write a review. Thanks so much for listening. Today we have Farnoosh Torabi on the show. Welcome to the show, Farnoosh.
Thank you so much, Laura. Congratulations on your new podcast. Very exciting.
Thank you. It's a privilege to have you here today.
Thank you.
So we all know you as this successful woman. You know, you're a contributor to the Today Show, ABC, the editor of Money Magazine, and author of three books. I even saw you have a Wikipedia page, voted number one podcast in finance. But I was reading and I saw, you know, it wasn't always like that. You talk about how at the age of 22, you were $30,000 in debt, living in New York. I was wondering if you could take us back to those early years and how you went from, you know, being in debt in New York City to, you know, where you are today.
Sure. It's expensive living in New York City at any age, especially when you're right out of school, very little financial training. I think I had some more coaching than most people my age, only because my dad, I remember having conversations here and there about money growing up, whether it was taking me to the credit union and helping me open up a savings account and talking about the importance of saving money. He helped me open up my first IRA. When I got my first job, he said, you got to get that 401k. And I was like, what is that?
Yeah.
So I kind of had an idea that money was important and that money, you should prioritize your financial responsibilities. But I was a spender, and I think I'm still a spender. But fortunately, now I make enough money to satisfy my spending needs. But back then, I think that I was exposed to so much materialism, and I wanted so much. And I think it was part of where I was in my life. I was at a very impressionable stage in my life. And I think that when you don't have money, that's when you want so many things, right? It's like when you don't have the financial means for something, you imagine your life will be so much greater if you just had X, Y, and Z. And largely those things fall into like the category of clothing and entertainment and going out and material things that have short-lived happiness. Mm-hmm. But my debt actually stemmed from student loans largely. There was about $4,000 or $5,000 from credit card debt that was stemming from college. And I knew enough that this was my responsibility, that I wasn't going to get a bailout. And I was so embarrassed and so worried that my parents would find out. Mm. I think that there was a conversation my mom and I had at one point. I was living on my own in New York for the first time. And she called me. I talked to my mom quite regularly at that age. And she said to me, did you hear about your cousin? Did you hear what happened? Did you hear what your aunt did? Meaning her sister. I said, what? What? I don't know. What happened? She goes, your cousin had about $60,000 in credit card debt. And I was like, and then $60,000 was more than I was making at that point. So to hear that someone had that in credit card debt, She said, and do you know what your aunt did? She just paid it off. And she goes, and basically she obviously disagreed with that and thought she was enabling him. She goes, well, it's only going to be a matter of time before he comes back to the well. And she said to me, don't you ever think that we're going to help you if you ever get in a situation like that? I think that she absorbed that experience that her sister went through and thought, holy bleep. Like if that ever is me, I you know, God forbid.
Right.
And she was really more concerned about covering her own financial well-being. And so she said to me, not knowing that here I was sitting with, I mean, they knew about the student loans, but the credit card debt wasn't making any dents in it. And if anything, I was adding a little bit more to it every month. And so that was sort of the wake up call that I had, that my mom probably didn't even realize she was giving me, that, you know, that fear of God that she gave to me, that I think got me eventually thinking more seriously about getting out of debt, creating an action plan. And my action plan was, look, I'm not making enough. I'm saving as much as I can. So I need to make more money. So I realized that rather than attacking the savings problem, I was going to attack the income problem. And so I started freelancing, making some side income. And this is before really the internet had taken off. I mean, there was the internet, but it wasn't where we are today. It's the robustness where we can connect with people and find jobs and work virtually. I started writing for a local newspaper. I babysat. I birdsat. I sold clothes. And so that's how I got the money to eventually pay down the debt. And then some, you really start to save. And this idea of building wealth at 22, 23 was not even a concept, but it was becoming more of a possibility and a more tangible thing once I got out of that debt and once I started to have some money to work with.
And I just have to ask, but how much could you possibly make as a bird sitter?
Well, this was the funny thing. I think I made $60 for the weekend, although I didn't have to live there. Obviously, I just had to visit and feed the bird and play with it for like let it out of its cage for a little bit and put it back in.
Yeah.
And do you know? Okay, so I got this job through a professor and she almost didn't pay me. I came to her house the day that she got back from her trip. And she invited me. So I figured, okay, this is where she's going to like give me her money, give me the money. And we sat and talked and talked and talked. And then she was like, okay, goodbye. And I was like, oh my God, really? Is this happening? You know, because for me, I was like, I don't bird sit for free. Like I need money and I'm poor. And so I got to the door and I turned around and I said, so how much were you planning to pay me? I just blurted it out. I don't even know if those were the words, but I said something about, I was like, money, me, how much can you pay? and there was an awkward pause and she was like, oh, would 60 be okay? And I was like, yes, that 60 would be great. I was like, I'll take what I can. And I think she either paid me then or I came back for the money, but it was so awkward. I was like, I think she was trying to pull a fast one over me. I think she was hoping to get her bird sat for free.
That's so messed up.
I know, right?
So I think that's incredible, right? To say, look, I can't really reduce my spending that much because I'm in New York City. So I'm going to earn more. But you know, you go on to say that, you know, money really isn't only about dollars and cents, right? It's also about these emotional barriers. And, you know, I talk about emotional layers and emotional weight. What have you found in all the work you've done, all the years you've thought about this? You know, are there consistent barriers for people, you know, people out there in debt right now? Is there something you've learned that could help them start the process?
Sure. I think that psychology has so much to do with how we manage or don't manage our money. And at this stage in where we are in the world and where we are with technology and accessibility to resources, it's not about lack of resources or getting the skills or getting the knowledge. If you want to learn how to get out of credit card debt, the information is out there. No mm-hmm. one's hiding it behind a gate. You don't have to pay for that information. It's there. It's pretty basic knowledge. I think what the barrier is really is our own inhibitions, our own fears, our own insecurities around money, what money means to us, the purpose of money. And, you know, I've worked on so many shows and I've written books about how our money stories growing up as kids, what money has meant to us over the years, good and bad, impacts how we deal with our money today. So if you grew up in a household where your parents didn't talk about money and it was considered rude, and yet there was tension in the house around money, it's not a coincidence that you grew up as an adult and you're still dealing with those awkwardness around money, that maybe you're not opening up your bills, you're not talking about money with your partner, mm-hmm. you're spending money a little recklessly because you just feel a need to act out mm-hmm. because you maybe grew up in a household that was a tight ship when it came to money and very strict when it came to spending. So you're acting out now as an adult. And I think, so what I find is that it's really important to go back to your money story and define what money means to you. Why is money important? What kind of a life do you want for yourself too? Because if you want a happy life and you want a fulfilling life, guess what? You need to be smart with your money. Mm-hmm. And it just is a part of the equation, and you may not like it. So if you don't like it, you need to get the support in place so that you can still have a healthy financial life, but have a support system around it. And I mean, I just interviewed someone on my show, on my podcast, who admitted, you know, I'm lazy, I'm forgetful, I don't really like dealing with money either. But yet he has developed systems around managing his money. He's automated things. He has a financial advisor. He deals with his money like once a quarter. He looks at his numbers, and that's it, because that's all he can handle.
Yeah.
But it works for him, and he's not in debt, and he has, you know, in fact, he's building a nice life.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, my brother is very interested in the idea of money, and he loves to talk about it and think about it. And I don't particularly think too hard about it, but I use him as somebody to guide and teach me. And I think, you know, if you're not that into it, getting a trusted individual in your life who can give you good advice. He got me to get a 401k, you know, when I was mm-hmm. 24. I would never have done that. I would have spent the money on, you know, more dinners out.
I feel as though, especially in the early stages of my adulthood and getting into the quote unquote real world and becoming an adult, like I said, I didn't know what a 401k was. It was my father who introduced it to me. And then later it was the HR woman at my first job who was like, you have to do this. Mm-hmm. Nothing else.
Yeah. Just, I mean, it seems automate. Crazy when you're that young to pull out your next pay raise, right?
Absolutely. And I was just happy to have a job. I wasn't going to ask for a raise, but it was my dad who, again, said, you should ask for more. You should negotiate. And so I did, in my timid way over the phone, didn't get the raise. But it did teach me something else, which was that there's no harm in asking. I didn't get fired. They did not give me the job because I asked for more money. And the next time I was up for a new job or promotion, it was that much easier to speak up.
Absolutely. And so you've moved on and talked about, you know, not just money and what it means to people, but specifically for women who are earning a lot of money, something that's really new to our culture. And you make one point that I wanted to ask you about, you know, that women have to be careful not to fall into the trap of doing it all. In my mm-hmm. work, I see this constantly. And truthfully, I'm in my 40s, but starting in my 30s with my friends and, you know, having kids and climbing the career ladder, it feels like every woman falls into this trap at some point. I did, and I had to make huge changes. What advice could you offer, you know, to those women out there who are, you know, trying to take it all on and mm-hmm. making a ton of money and doing well in their life, and just stressed as, you know, as can be?
Well, I actually read a really interesting article about women and time the other day, and I think it was on Jezebel or one of those websites for women. And essentially, it was this long article about how, going back to, looking at it through history, women never really associated time with personal time. Like, we would, as a woman in, like, especially, let's go back to modern, recent history, like the 50s, women worked for the family. We give so much of ourselves to this day, to others, to our jobs, to our families, to our parents, to our neighbors, that when we have 10 minutes to spare, our instinct isn't to go, oh, I should get a massage, or I'm going to take a nap, or I'm going to sit here and read a book. Uh-huh. It's like, maybe I should cook dinner. Maybe I should plan something this. So it's almost like we're hardwired to always be accountable to others mm-hmm. and working on others' behalfs, because we're givers. We are. That's our human nature. We're were the communicators, the network builders, the family builders, the village builders, the community were the rock, right? So I think that in some ways is what makes us magnificent, but at the same time, to our detriment, if we're not conscious about valuing our time to ourselves and being good to ourselves, then it's nobody wins, mm-hmm. because you have to take care of yourself if you want to take care of others. And
what do you say to that woman out there who's saying, yeah, but you know, you don't understand, my lists have lists and I have more lists.
Yeah. First of all, stop adding to the list. I mean, I think I love lists, but if you're spending more time checking your list than doing things, I think, you know, it's consciousness. No, you have to be really conscious about, and really reflection is important too. Looking through the last 6 months, the last week even, and appreciating all the things that you've accomplished as opposed to all the things that you didn't do. Mm-hmm. I think that's a mindset shift that sometimes is important because it forces us to really appreciate our hard work and look at our lives differently and look at the way that we're living our lives differently and value our time differently. And I would also say to that woman that, what is your time worth? What is your time worth? There's actually a way to figure this out. I think it was Tim Ferriss who wrote about it in his book, The 4-Hour Workweek, and he said that everyone has more or less a value to their time, and it's the way you figure it out is you take your annual income. Let's try hypothetical. Let's say it's $100,000. Knock off the last three zeros. Then whatever number's left, in this case 100, divided by 2, that's 50. So your hourly wage is $50 an hour. Mm-hmm. If it costs you less to pay someone to do something for you, whether it's cleaning your home, organizing your office, running errands, then it's worth it. If it costs something, if you have to pay more than $50 an hour to have someone do something for you, then it's not to say that it's not worth it, but you have to, maybe you need to reconcile that. But I think there are several things that people can do for you that's lower than your pay wage. And I think that's a nice way for people who can't rationalize outsourcing their work to others, see the mathematical proof in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the guilt factor underneath it, right? That,
right.
Even if you've done the math and you say to yourself, yeah, but I feel bad. You know, the question becomes, well, how did women who in the 1950s ran a whole house and felt very tired by that process now take on jobs, you know, competing with guys who have been working 80 hours? If you just add the math up of that amount of time you're trying to put into your right. life, it doesn't work, right? That's like 2 12-hour jobs.
And I think one of the great things I'm seeing happening, one of the trends and one of the shifts is the family dynamic. So if you're in a marriage or in a relationship or a partnership and there's two of you, that's a great thing. There are two of you to get everything done, mm-hmm. right? And I think sometimes from a female perspective, as a woman, I've experienced this. I feel like a failure if I ask for help, right? I feel like I'm not good at what I set out to do if I need to offshore, outsource, or literally just ask for help. I want to be the champion. I want to prove to myself and be that ideal wife, mother, colleague, sister. I want to shine. And I think that even if it means staying up till 1 a.m. Yeah. to fold laundry, and then, you know, listen to that. That's crazy. I mean, in my research for When She Makes More, I discovered that when she makes more, she actually does more housework than a woman who makes the same or less than her partner. And the psychology behind that is that when she makes more, it's not yet really a feminine role, right? And so she overcompensates by doing all this housewifery yeah. stuff yeah. to feel more female, which is insane, but also understandable, because look at the society we live in. We still live in a very traditional society. If you did a study and looked at America's values and value system around family and family life and the roles of men and women, and dominantly, I think like 67%, 2/3 of Americans, both men and women, believe that it was a man's responsibility to be able to support a family entirely mm-hmm. in marriage, like you know, a third felt that way, that women should be able to have financial independence and a way to financially support a family. So what does that tell us? That we're living in 2016, while society is growing rapidly and how we live our lives and how we design our families is changing and evolving, that our mindsets are still stuck in the olden days.
Yeah.
And so between mindset and what's actually happening before our eyes, there's a barrier that we have to reconcile, that we have to work through. And I think the key is to be honest. If you feel emasculated because your wife makes more, if you feel like you're wearing the quote unquote pants in the relationship as a woman and you don't like that feeling because you want to feel feminine and you want to, whatever the feminine means to you. I think that we don't discuss these things out loud because even as I say it, I feel like I cringe a little bit because I'm like, well, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. So dated, feminine, masculine, but gender is real, and there are gender differences. And I think you need to at least acknowledge it. And I think that's the first step. And if you're not comfortable with something, to work around it. And when you're in a relationship, you're not running for office. You don't have to be politically correct, right? You're in a relationship, hopefully in a relationship where you trust each other and there is respect and you can share your ideas no matter how wild they are. But it's a dance. I'm finding that as a newly married woman, that a relationship is a far different obstacle course than running a business, than being in a friendship. It's so different. It's so nuanced. And the challenge is speaking your mind in the moment. We bottle things up and we don't talk and then communication breaks down and then you drift apart. And that's what I see where in these particular relationships where she makes more, that's exactly what happens. There's more divorce, there's more infidelity. So that's why I wanted to write the book, to be able to support these relationships and find the solutions to not only teach myself, but others who are in this scenario.
I had the high paying job. I was an executive after we sold our company. And, as you said that, I realized, yeah, I was making more lists at the height of my career than ever. I was doing more at home. I was pushing myself harder. And it was ridiculous. And I kept saying over and over, I'm getting like a B- everywhere, no matter how hard I work, because it's impossible. And I think for everybody out there, just thinking about what makes sense for you, right? Not necessarily what culture is dictating, because a lot of it is antiquated and we're shifting so much. And, what makes you happy? What matters to you? And really setting some priorities for yourself.
Yeah, it's really about less is more. Be good to yourself. Do what you want. Outsource the rest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Great advice. So, if that all wasn't enough, you decided to start a podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about that process? What got you involved in the podcast So Money? It's, doing phenomenally well. You have amazing guests on. But what was the transition to get this going?
Well, I guess I go back to a few years before the podcast. I was working on a video series for Yahoo. It was called Financially Fit. And we had a blast. It was 3 years, which is, I feel like in the internet world is like, 21 years, like dog years. It's a long time to be given this opportunity. And then the budget kept getting bigger. We got to travel and it was phenomenal. I mean, I felt we really brought a lot to the conversation that was happening around money. And we had a following and then it went away one day. A new CEO came into town. You know who she is. And lots of things changed, including our show, which was given the bye-bye. And it was really unexpected. And it was sad because it was like, well, we're only getting better. I don't understand. But it was a whole change in the company's culture and purpose. And okay, I get it. I've been laid off before. I get it. I'm a big girl. I got laid off and I was actually like 8 weeks pregnant too, which was great timing.
Right.
But I had other things to look forward to. I was like, okay, you know what? This is okay because I have my book that's coming out, my When She Makes More, that was coming out that spring. It was coming out in May. My baby was due in June. So I spent the whole, winter, spring focusing on the book launch, had a very successful book launch, which is great because I had time now to really dedicate to a proper book launch. So all things work out, right?
Yeah.
And then I went on maternity leave over the summer and I was eager to get back to work. And I thought, what can I do? I don't have a book. I have a book, but I don't really have a book anymore. I mean, the book's launched and said and done and don't have a video show anymore. And who am I? I had a bit of as many entrepreneurs, I'm sure you've gone through this too. You have these like identity crises moments where it's ridiculous because you have this a massive body of work. And so you should, but you're only as good as your last project. I feel like sometimes you have to always keep putting out, you know, it's like a hamster on a wheel. You got it. What's your next thing? Everyone asks, what's your next book? What's your next thing? And so I felt pressure to eject myself from maternity leave and like shoot myself out of a cannon and be like, world, I'm back. I'm better than ever. And I've lost all the baby weight. Not. And so I thought about it. I thought, well, maybe I thought, okay, maybe I'll do it. I'll just do the video series on my own. Screw Yahoo. I'll just get my, I'll invest in a crew and we'll do it. And I, you know, but then I was like, no, that's not going to work because the formula why that show was successful was because we were on Yahoo. You know, I mean, yeah. I like to think that the show would have been successful anywhere, but truthfully, I mean, Yahoo has unparalleled traffic. You know, there's no one like Yahoo, maybe Google, but that's it.
Yeah.
And so, and then it's also kind of expensive to shoot every day. And so I thought that's pie in the sky idea. And then I started to, as I was doing the book launch, like going back a few months, I did a few podcasts to promote the book. And honestly, whenever I got the request to be on a podcast, I would kind of be like, okay, who's going to listen? I really didn't respect the podcast yet. I was a little skeptical. I thought, well, who, you know.
I had to first ask, what's a podcast?
Like, yeah. I mean, I knew what a podcast was, but I was skeptical. I thought, I didn't think there was an audience. I didn't think that.
Yeah.
It was worth my time because these podcasts take 30 minutes, an hour. I'm like, well, geez, like I go on the Today Show for 3 minutes and I get a lot more bang for my time. Anyway, I started to meet people in the podcast world just through getting back into work and networking. And I went to FinCon, which is the annual financial bloggers conference. And I remember being at a cocktail hour one night there, and someone pulled me aside and we were talking about podcasting and how much money he makes and what he does and his format. And I was like, shit, I need a podcast. I need to do a podcast because we haven't talked about this. I have a master's in broadcast journalism. I worked in TV news. I was an anchor woman. I was a producer. I get the format. You know, I did radio for a little bit, so I wasn't shy to the production aspect of podcasting. Mm-hmm. The trick now is figuring out what's my show? What is it about? Why me?
Yeah.
And I thought back to, well, what is the show that I've always wanted to do that I've even pitched to the powers that be at the various networks and Yahoo? And they were like, oh, that's a good idea. Pat me on the head. Go back to work. And I thought, let's interview some movers and shakers, everyone from a celebrity to a millionaire next door to authors, entrepreneurs, celebrities, athletes, musicians, artists, chefs, about the one thing that everyone deals with, one of the one things that everyone deals with, which is money. Mm-hmm. Whether you are rich, poor, successful, you have a financial point of view, you have experiences, you have wins, you have losses. Let's unearth those. And through these conversations, teach listeners about what money means to people and how they get through problems and how they've achieved so much and their habits and really effectively opening the conversation that is, it's still a taboo topic, really like opening the floodgates around money, because I think that needs to happen before we can really get down to business and make change. So that was my big idea. And I thought, I wrote a book. My first book was called You're So Money way back when. And I thought, let's just kind of abbreviate that and just call it So Money. Hmm. And little by little, I basically took between September of 2014 and December of 2014 to plan it out. I had like, you know, Venn diagrams, charts, little workspace. I had all my equipment. I bought too much equipment. I would pick anyone's brain about a podcast. I would read everything I could about podcasts. I just became a podcast fiend. and eventually just launched in January. I had a plan to do it. I did 7 days a week, which is crazy, but I stuck with that for a long time. Eventually went to 5 days a week, launched with Tony Robbins and Robert Kiyosaki and some of my, you know, just my heroes, and eventually built momentum. It was a slow burn. You know, at first I thought, oh, I'm going to break into the podcast world and I'm going to get a million downloads. No, it didn't happen.
What was the turning point? Was there a specific moment where it turned, and or is it just a slow and steady?
It was for a lot. I would say I would attribute a lot of it to the slow and steadiness. I think that my experience and work with media, you know, I publish, I know a lot of journalists. I know how to pitch. I would pitch my podcast out there and get, I was really vocal about the show. And I think getting my name out there helped in various publications. I got mentioned in Inc. magazine and Forbes and Money magazine and Business Insider, actually. Business Insider, I don't know if any of you read Business Insider, but they have a very devout following. And one of the, I think, the game changers for me was, I still do this. I publish transcripts for my shows and people can access them. It's free. Business Insider eventually caught on to this. And because my show is very much in line with their audience's interests, occasionally the writers there would go to my transcript archives and pluck interesting, you know, tidbits from my interviews and create articles around them, unbeknownst to me.
Oh, wow.
But they just knew that it existed. So it was like, you know, these reporters have to churn 4 or 5 stories out a day. So my transcripts are bounty for these reporters. So, because I'm interviewing, you know, in some cases, Jim Cramer and people that are really in line with their audience's interests. And those articles where they would reference my podcast, link to the podcast, I would see huge spikes. In fact, one day I woke up and it wasn't even, I haven't had my coffee yet. And I saw my downloads for a particular day were 5 times what they usually are in a day.
Wow.
I was like, what is, I thought the internet broke. If that's possible. I was like, did the World Wide Web fall on its back? Like I didn't trust it. I thought it was broken. I thought that it was hacked. I thought like Libsyn, which is my server, like had lost its mind. And then I did a Google search and I discovered that there was an article about my podcast in Business Insider, and not even like just, it was just like, oh, this person, Farnoosh interviewed so-and-so and here's a quote and here's a link. It wasn't even a Valentine to my podcast. It was just, here's a really cool interview that she did.
The internet is so funny that way. I mean, will wake up and I have like a ton of subscribers and I think, well, what's, and I do the same thing. I look at Google Analytics and see that, you know, somebody picked up a blog post and posted it somewhere in Lifehacker and they're all talking about it. And I was like, how did that happen? It's so amazing.
Wow. Yeah. And now, I'm curious to hear your startup story.
Well, I could only hope it comes close to what you've been able to do. It's amazing. Clearly you've hit a chord with people. And you know, money is a big subject. So, you know, from the outside looking in, you have everything that most people would equate with a successful life. You've written books. You've have this incredible career. You know, you have this amazing podcast. But success without authenticity is the real focus of this podcast. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what an authentic life means to you. How do you have that sense of success and authenticity?
It's really important for me to feel grounded. And I have the fortune of having a husband who makes sure of that. my husband does not work in media. He doesn't want much in life. You know, he wants health and family and happiness and the simple pleasures. And I think I can get really caught up in my world because it's easy. You know, I work in media and it's very glitzy sometimes and it's fast moving and it's all about, you hear right away if people liked your stuff, didn't like your stuff, and you can get really caught up in criticism and comments. And I mean, when I worked at Yahoo, I would put out what I thought was a great video and then you'd read the comments and it was like, die. I hope you get hit by a bus. I'm not exaggerating.
Really? That didn't really happen.
People are crazy, I've learned, on the internet who comment. They can be. Largely, people who comment are angry people. And
yeah.
So that hurt. And I think I went through a phase where I was not appreciating my work. I was focusing so much on the negative. And even though I was successful and I was, I think for me, like knowing that what I'm doing is authentic, it's being able to, and feeling authentic along the way is surrounding myself with people that support me, that are reminding me too of, you know, the small but important steps in life and the importance of family dinner and the importance of calling your mom and dad if you haven't talked to them in a couple of weeks, and making sure that you're taking care of yourself, that you're getting enough sleep, that yes, you have this career and you're very happy with it, but it's nothing if your home life is in shambles, and it's nothing if you feel like your real relationships that matter don't exist or aren't supportive, or it's a one-way street. And so it's taken time. You know, I don't think that all my friendships were valid and helpful throughout my 20s. And I've since, you know, have a smaller community of people around me. And I feel very lucky that I found my husband and we have a family now. And those are the things that are important to me. And I don't tolerate any more people and ideas and comments that hurt, that don't help. And it's hard to say no. It's hard to reject people. It's hard to turn people away. It's hard to break relationships off. But sometimes you have to make those hard decisions to keep yourself happy and feel that what you're doing is that you're leaving a meaningful and fulfilling life and that you're being true to yourself. You have to care for yourself. And that's hard to make time to do, you know, because I kind of think sometimes, like, if I wasn't married, if I didn't have a kid, I didn't have all these responsibilities on the home front, I would be so much more ahead in my career. I just know I would be, because I see friends who are single and they're just head down working, 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 working. And they make more money than I do. But that wouldn't make me happy. It's interesting to watch and analyze. But I know that for me, I would always feel like something's missing. And that at some point I would get to a point where I'd feel like, what the hell am I doing with my life? And so I feel grateful that I'm able to have that. I don't call it balance, but I have all this integration in my life.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you're listening to your inner voice and what makes sense for you know, you and your friendships and making those changes. And was that something that you were always good at, or it sounds like you in your 20s maybe had the friendships or the life that, you know, yeah, wasn't so good? Like, was it a process to make that change, or how did you?
It was, I remember, I can give you an example. It started, I think, with a friend that I made in graduate school, and we instantly were drawn to each other. You know, almost like you go into a new school or work and you want to find your people, right? So I felt like I found my person, and we were in all of our classes together, and she was funny and she was great to hang out with. But I knew that along the way, I would like hit a wall with her. We weren't able to really get deep about things. And I think she was someone that truly, like, maybe in her life, she was hurt and she had her own issues to work through, but we would never talk about them. And I felt that in some ways too, that she was being competitive and supporting me into my face, but not behind my back. And I just got evidence of that one day without getting specific. I discovered that she said something very damaging about me, to someone that could have been, you know, it could have gotten back to my boss. It was really, I mean, that I just drew the line in the sand right mm-hmm. then and there. And I thought, I have what I need now to never talk to this person again. And I don't even need to tell her why, because I think she knows. She has to know. And it's easy these days in some ways, like, just don't answer the phone when they call. Don't respond to their emails. It's not the best way. I wish maybe I should have been more big and said, you know, I didn't appreciate that. And I think we should just, you know, we should not spend so much time together. I was too uncomfortable to say those words out loud, but maybe if I could have, I wish I had. And there was actually a New York Times article about breaking up with friends. The thing is, you go through your 20s and you just collect friends. You do. Everyone's a friend. Yeah. Oh, I like you. Let's hang out. You're fun. I like your ponytail. I like your shoes. oh, you went to Penn State. I went to Penn State. So you have suddenly you have like 10 bridesmaids at your wedding.
Right. Right.
They're not all your bridesmaids. They're not all your friends. Really?
No, there's a cleansing that happens in your late 20s. I don't know. I feel like every woman I know, it's like in late 20s.
Shedding.
There's a shedding that happens. It's just they've, you know, the toxic ones have to go. And if you haven't done that, you know, think about who's toxic in your life.
Toxicity. I learned that from Real Housewives. That word. And relating it to people. I didn't think people could be toxic, but indeed they can be.
Oh my God. So toxic. You know, people... Some people, they just, the question I always ask, does this person drain my energy or increase it?
Right.
Yeah. And you know, right away, the person, like all of us, I think could take 10 seconds and say, oh yeah, that person really just zaps me.
Or exhausts me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend like that. And I love her dearly. There's nothing wrong with her.
Right.
But like, she's a perfect human. But together, we're not compatible. And I don't. And, you know, it's terrible when you feel like you feel this way, but you're not sure they understand that it's a one-way street here, that they just keep dumping on you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So do you have daily practices or habits to stay authentic? I call them emotional workouts, but do you have a couple you could share with the audience?
I think it's just getting down on the floor and playing with my son. Mm. I think that it's easy not to. It's easy to just let him play and be on my phone. It's easy to let him play and be on the laptop or be on watching TV. I've had those bad. I mean, I'm not a perfect parent, and I probably let him watch more TV than I should. But I try once. My husband's very good at that. He's just a really playful guy. I'm not very playful. Kids love me. I don't know. The kids do come to me and like hang out. I feel like I'm the kid whisperer. Like I'll be on a subway and the child will find me. Someone's child will find me and sit on my lap. Like it just happens.
That's hilarious.
And so I embrace that, but I feel like for me, it's always been to an extent. And now when I have a child, I want to be really in it with him and in it to win it and like down there and playing, and he's a boy and he likes his trucks. So it's like, you know, if maybe it was a girl, I'd be a little more into it. But I love the time that I spend with him, and I want him to, he's too little to remember, of course, these moments, but I think that it's important for me to experience them and to really like stare at him and try to capture and memorize his facial expressions. I take tons of pictures and videos, but I just also too want to be in the moment with him as well.
Yeah, there's nothing like a child to bring you back to your center.
Right.
Well, I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much for your time. I loved our conversation, and I just appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much. This was a really fun conversation. Great questions. You've been on my show as well. So everyone check out Laura on So Money and learn about her.
Absolutely.
Stories and all the good stuff.
And if people want more information about the podcast or what you're up to, what's the best place to find you?
SoMoneyPodcast.com.
Easy enough. Thank you so much, Farnoosh.
Thank you, Laura. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you found some value in this interview. If so, it would mean the world to me if you hit subscribe, completed an iTunes review, or shared it with a friend. Every little bit counts. I'm super grateful for every single one of you, and I couldn't be more excited to be here. Signing off, I'm Laura Koh, and I'll see you guys next week.